or you're eating in the back seat of the car on the way to soccer practice, we're extracting joy from our lives. And then you would see this whole new generation of joyless people, right? You know, or people that don't know how to maybe connect, truly connect with one another without a phone in front of their face to text something to the person that they're sitting next to. And that seems a bit extreme, but I see it. If we can have food that is clean and good and fair, isn't that what you want to be putting in your bodies? Isn't that what we want our children to be putting in their bodies?
You're listening to Food Integrity Now with your host, Carol Gervais.
Hello and welcome to Food Integrity Now. I'm Carol Gervais. I am a certified holistic nutritionist and the host of the show. At Food Integrity Now, we like to investigate and explore what's happening in our food supply so that you can make wise decisions for your health and for your family's health. And I'd like to give a big shout out to Ben Sound Music for our intro and outro music. We've got a really fun and uplifting show for you today. My guest today is Leah DiBernardo, and she is the founder and award-winning chef of EAT, Extraordinary Artisan Table. EAT was born out of a decade of catering and event production under Delight's Fine Food. EAT opened its door on Valentine's Day 2011 in Temecula, California, featuring locally foraged and an in-house crafted menu, a sustainable education, an event space, and a home delivery service of already prepared healthy organic meals. Recognizing that improving our food system and our health starts with showing people how to source and utilize sustainable, clean ingredients, Leah conceptualized a new kind of eatery that is delicious, ethical, and sustainable. She also believes that supporting local growers and food artisans will ultimately make sustainable food available to everyone. She is motivated by her daughter and the importance of feeding clean food to children. She spearheaded over 24 academic and edible school garden programs. She is committed to bringing real food to the masses. She believes in community through food, and that gathering around the table and sharing good food is what connects us to family, friends, and community. Hi, it's Carol Gervais, and I am a certified holistic nutritionist, a life coach, and the host of Food Integrity Now. What you eat and how you eat can greatly affect the way you look and feel, and whether or not you get sick. If your immune system is compromised, you might have brain fog, allergies, low energy, depression, have trouble sleeping, you might be overweight, perhaps you get frequent colds, or worse, have a disease. A poor diet can lead to diabetes, cancer, Alzheimer's, dementia, heart disease, obesity, and virtually all other diseases. I take great pride in working with individuals and groups and seeing how they create such positive changes in their lives. I offer one-on-one coaching packages, or we can design a package just for your group. To find out more, go to foodintegritycoaching.com or call me at 415-302-7100 for your free consultation. I offer phone and Skype sessions, and this really is all about quality of life. Let me assist you to have the best quality ever. Do you drink almond milk? Do you know that packaged almond milk contains all sort of nasty additives like carrageenan and barely contains any actual almonds? The good news is that you can make fresh almond milk at home in minutes. Once you taste the creamy, fresh flavor of homemade almond milk, you'll never go back. I make my almond milk at home with a Nutiana nut milk bag. It's great, easy to use, easy to clean, and makes my almond milk silky smooth. Buy yours today by searching the Nutiana nut milk bag on Amazon.
That's NUTIANA, not milk bag. Or go to Nutiana.com.
You're going to love this bag. Leah, welcome to the show.
Hi, Carol. Thanks for having me.
Well, I am thrilled to interview you today and to learn more about what you're doing. Did you always want to be a chef? A little background of how you ended up where you are today.
Sure. No, I did not actually want to be a chef. My grandfather was a restaurant owner and a chef. My aunts were avid cookers. There was always something going on around our house with food. And I always had a natural ability towards it and was cooking at a very young age. My earliest memory, I think, is like 4 years old when we lived on this farm in Terrebonne, Oregon. And my dad grew a great deal of our food and some row crops. And we also raised our own animals. And I was always just aghast at the fact that my dad would butcher our pets, right?
Oh, yeah.
I was like, I swore myself off to be a vegetarian, and I was a vegetarian most of my young adult life. But I got into film because I really wanted to tell important stories and what were important stories to me. And, long story short, I found my way into food when I had my daughter, in the early 2000s and, decided to move out to Temecula, and there's such a prolific, really beautiful ag region out here. And it really just spoke to me. And I thought, you know, this is something that I want to do. I want to tell the stories of these farmers, these small, food artisans, and, I'll figure out how to kind of weed myself into it in a way that is not maybe all consuming like a restaurant. But, you know, lo and behold, I ended up with an eatery, which is kind of comical. But no, it was not my first choice, but I will tell you that the stories of food and the people involved in food are some of the most beautiful I've ever encountered.
Wow. Well, that kind of leads into my second question, which is, I've heard you speak about conversations around the table. Let's talk a little bit about that and why you feel that's so important.
Well, it's, you know, it seemed to me that so many people have, with maybe technology, maybe that's it, with all the advancements of technology, we're missing that those beautiful conversations that used to happen around the table. We weren't allowed to go outside and play or, you know, be busy with homework or anything for that matter when I was growing up between the hours of supper time. You had to be at that table, and everybody took turns around our table when we were growing up in our American Italian family of sharing what happened throughout your day. And I saw so much of that just disappear. And I did a TED talk a few years ago, and it was actually around conversations of the table. Where did they go? And, you know, we're missing that joy. And if you just take a little bit of time to sit down and break bread with your family or your friends, then you bring back that spark, right? There's so much that happens around the table that we forget about. You know, political conversations, personal conversations, all of a sudden we're discovering what happened in our child's day, our spouse's day, and wow, I didn't know that was happening, and how can I fix that, or just comedy even. So one of the things we work at EAT, and it was really important to me that we have from day one what we call community style tables. So you have to sit with other people, or if you don't, there's a few two tops and around the restaurant, but it was really important that community sits with community, and you maybe discover something new about someone that you live in the same city with. Because it's almost like we've forgotten what compassion is like and listening. Because everything's so fast paced and there's such a demand, you know, of everyone's time. So if you can just slow down a little bit, sit down and eat and talk.
Right. And I've noticed, and I'm sure you've noticed this quite a bit, is that people tend to, even a couple coming together, they'll both pull out their cell phone and they're not having a conversation. They're texting, they're, you know, catching up on their day. And it seems like it's a lost art.
It is a lost art. And, you know, I laugh because you know, I see so much of this again at the eatery with even parents that come in, and they're, even if it's one or two, they're both on their phone and the kids are literally running around the restaurant, and we're having to ask them kindly, right, to, can you maybe put your phones down and pay attention to your children, because they're tearing up the restaurant. But it's almost an epidemic.
Yeah, I agree. I kind of want to interject a funny little story. I had to go to a laundromat yesterday, and there was a family sitting at a table waiting for theirs. And the children, as young as maybe 2.5 or 3, they all had their little video games or phones in their hand. And I was just watching that nobody was talking. Everybody had their own little electronic thing going on. And I was thinking how sad that was.
Yeah, it is. And we inspire the reverse of that at EAT. And we're fortunate enough to be able to get away with asking that of our customer base. And even the kids, sometimes if I see that a parent's on a device, I'll just go over and I'll ask if I can take the little one into the kitchen or take them for a quick tour, just anything to get the parents' attention, to maybe get them off the phone, right, and pay attention to what's happening at the table. But then just the children, just really, you know, engaging them. It's almost like, you know, when I was little, or, you know, there was always this joke about, oh, you know, kids, you know, they just need to be quiet and they need to know their place, right? Well, it almost seems like we're doing that through technology. Well, we just need them to be quiet and know their place. It's like, there's nothing convivial about that. And that is a lost art. And it's kind of sad if you think about it. So we want to bring it back. We want to look at the positives of that and how can we engage people to sit around the table, break bread with one another, and have a good time. Food's delicious. It, you know, and conversations are delicious, and we're meant to do that as human beings.
Right. And I agree. I'm a total foodie. So that's one of my favorite things, is standing in my kitchen cooking with friends.
Totally. Absolutely. Yeah.
So what do you think led us away from the table? How did we become a nation of fast food and not coming home and getting together with family and having breaking bread, as you said?
Wow. That's, you know, it's, I mean, historically you could go back and you can kind of just look at history and what even started happening, you know, in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, with when we started to create fast food. And then up to World War II, when, you know, all of a sudden our agricultural demands on this country got huge, you know, absolutely immense, with producing more and more and more, because then all of a sudden the demand's there. Well, how do we keep up with that? So we're now treating our soil a completely different way, and we're farming in a different way. And that conversation right there, demand, having to have more, leads into then the next generation. Well, I have to work more. I have to make more because I want more. I want what they have. And it's always just be, you know, generation after generation up until really the millennials. It's the first time I'm starting to see this switch back to, no, more is not better. And having a lot of something doesn't mean it's good for you or can be better for you. And it's this, like, this reverse going away from more and going away from cheap, because yeah, that's really what it comes down to. And we're seeing this really cool reverse within that conversation. And it's kind of exciting, actually, because you could have asked me this question 16 years ago when I really first started to get into food advocacy, and I would have not had a lot of positive things to say.
There definitely is a trend now, and people are starting to wake up and question, what have we done? What are we doing? How did we get here? When did we think that putting poison in our food was a good idea?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, asking questions like that. I'm a food advocate too, and I just think the education is so important, which brings me to the question I have about your involvement with some of the schools and what you're doing with the gardens. Love to hear about this.
Oh, absolutely. It's one of my favorite conversations, topics of conversation. I when I moved out to Temecula, I was living in New York and Los Angeles, and I was working in the film industry as an independent producer, film producer for commercials and music videos. And when I moved out to Temecula, it was with my daughter because I knew I wanted to raise her just in a smaller town environment. And that was my transition into food. And I started to look at the schools and what was happening in the schools, even in a place like Temecula. And I was shocked at what I was finding. And I was very aware of what Alice Waters was doing up in Berkeley, what she has done with school gardens throughout our country. And so I got involved with Slow Food, and I made this commitment to change the conversation around food within our public school system here in Temecula. And we had 26 public schools, elementary, here in the Valley when I started doing that, and that was in 2002. And I met with one of the assistants of the school district, and she was just fantastic, Jody McClay. She inspired me. She's like, instead of going in and changing food within our cafeterias, because that's maybe not the best way to go, it's going to take too much. Why don't you start with gardens? And I'm like, well, that's a no-brainer. I can't believe I didn't think about that, considering that, you know, I've been researching Alice and what she's been doing in our country. So we did. We got teachers together. Jody was awesome. She put out an email for us to principals, vice principals, and teachers, and we had 40 people show up at our door. It was amazing. And we said, what can we do to support you to get gardens up and running in every single one of our schools? And we did it in a year. In 1 year, we had gardens in every single school, and it was absolutely amazing and important. And it's difficult to keep them going. I'm not saying it was just like overnight, a snap of the fingers, and oh my gosh, look what we did. It was really the kids. It's the kids who keep the gardens going. It's their interest and their demand and their love of the garden that keeps that conversation going. So that's kind of how it started. And where I'm at right now is just really dedicated to keep all of the gardens going and be as instrumental as I can within the programs with the kids.
Well, how does that work within the school system? Then they have just different age levels tended, or how does that work? How does the mechanics work with that?
Honestly, it's all up to the teachers. I would love to see it be a precedence where you absolutely have to, from history to art to music to English and science, go out to the garden at least once a week and have a class out there. But, you know, we don't have that. And that's something I'm still fighting for, and I'm hoping to make that change. But right now it's just up to the teachers. But what a lot of the teachers that I stay in contact with that do go out have told me, and it's the best story, that the kids that have the most problem learning or the most difficulties are super, super hyper. They take, depending on the age range, they take them out to the garden, and that completely changes it. They've noticed a difference in their academics, how they perform in the classroom, within their energy levels. So then those teachers obviously have discovered something. So they continue to go out on a weekly basis, sometimes more. And then there's just some teachers, and understandably, they're very inundated, you know, with all the rigmarole from Common Core and everything else that they're told they have to do, that it's hard for them to always think outside of the box. Maybe not think outside of the box, I take that back, but to do something outside of the box because of their time constraints and limitations. But I have to say that getting those kids out into the garden, getting their hands in the dirt, letting them take a seed and grow a plant, and then they see what that plant produced, that they helped that plant produce because they're the ones who planted it, it becomes this whole new conversations with children. You know, they're like, I grew this. Look at this. I'm going to make a salad, and I'm going to eat everything in that bowl, when they would never touch a carrot or a red pepper, you know, or cilantro or anything green for that matter. So it's really a beautiful thing to see kids out in a garden. And if there's any teachers listening, I just have to tell you that it will change the way you do things, and it will change the conversation within your classroom.
Wow. And it didn't even seem like it was that difficult to get it going.
It's not difficult to get it going. That's just the thing. It's difficult to continue it and to have consistency, because then, you know, you have a teacher that left or a principal that left or parents that are no longer there because they were there for first through fifth and then now they're gone. And those are the parents that dedicated their time. But it has to be about community. You have to have that conviviality with the garden, and you have to have family, teacher, school, kid, being involved, because if you don't, then when, a certain grade leaves, of course it's going to fall off. But it is about that it's easy to start gang, but it's hard to keep it going with anything in life, being consistent.
Right. Well, where did the money come for the individual schools?
At the time, Maria Schwarzenegger had a grant out there for $2,500 or $2,800. And we got one for every single school.
That is amazing. You know, and that's a very good point, Leah. There's grant money out there to do things like
that. Oh, there's so much grant money. When you put these words together, hi, I have an academic and an edible garden at my school. Academic? Okay, well, that's huge for Common Core. And then edible? That's huge on a nonprofit basis. So all of a sudden you marry those two. There's so much out there, from Lowe's to Home Depot to small mom and pop businesses to that kitchen company called OXO, O-X-O.
Uh-huh.
That just Google them. There's so much money out there available to schools for garden programs. And, of course, Slow Food USA.
Let's talk about that, because I know you were very involved with Slow Food, and share with our listeners what Slow Food is, just so they can know more about it.
Absolutely. I have since stepped down from the board. It's been a few years now that I've been involved with Slow Food, but for about a decade I was very involved. And Slow Food USA, they have groups and chapters around our country, actually around the entire world. But it stands for good, clean, and fair food. And what we mean by that conversation is that, you know, you want your food good, delicious, right? Why would we want anything other than that? We want it fair, meaning that the people who grow it, the people who work for the people who grow it, the people who cook it are all paid a fair wage. And clean, you know, free of pesticides, antibiotics, herbicides, GMOs, all of that crap that doesn't belong in food or in our soil. So in a nutshell, that's what Slow Food is about. And it's a beautiful conversation to be part of. And I would urge anyone to Google Slow Food and get involved with their local chapters.
Mm-hmm. And weren't you instrumental in getting Slow Food into the schools too?
Oh yeah, that was, absolutely. Because it helped with the gardens. We literally had a middle school out here at Hillcrest Academy in Temecula. They started a middle school chapter, and they were the first school in the nation to actually bring Slow Food onto a school campus, even before colleges had them. And it was a pretty cool thing to see 12 and 13 and 14 year olds engaged in this conversation and making a difference on their campus. The mayor of Temecula at the time, Marianne Edwards, had actually, I forget what it's called. She had awarded one of the students a proclamation. She gave the student a proclamation and named a day after them for achieving what they have achieved at that school when it came to the environment and the conversation of food and their school garden. And I thought that was pretty cool. But there's many schools, public to private, that are doing it now. And it's exciting, because why just have, you know, a club around music or art? What about food? That's still a brilliant conversation to be having.
It's going to start with the kids if we're going to turn things around.
Absolutely. That is so, so important. And I'm happy you said that. It does start with the kids. When the children bring it home and they say, hey, mom, look, I want to grow this. Can we just start a garden in a little milk crate? Can we start it in a small bed? Can we then take it out to the backyard or the side yard? It's the kids that are doing it.
It is so important that we teach our kids about food.
I mean, just the conversation we were having with you know, what happens in restaurants, you know, and not being convivial and paying attention to one another and speaking to each other, from, you know, all the way to our health. It's food has played a major role since day one. You go back in history, back to our cavemen, you know, you're gathering around that fire, you're learning things from each other. You're eating, you're loving one another. And without kids learning the basics of one, how to grow food or how to prepare food, and you just go home to a fast food meal, or you're running out to a restaurant, or you're eating in the backseat of the car on the way to soccer practice, we're extracting joy from our lives. And then you would see this whole new generation of joyless people, right? You know, or people that don't know how to maybe truly connect with one another without a phone in front of their face to text something to the person that they're sitting next to. And that seems a bit extreme, but I see it.
I agree wholeheartedly. I love that. We're extracting joy. It's like a missed opportunity.
It is. But it goes right to, you know, the conversation of our health. And one of the demands I'm seeing right now, and I am so stoked to see this in the trends of food, is the demand for food that is not cheap. And that doesn't mean that it has to be gourmet or expensive, gang. It just means that cheap food isn't the best way to go. And if we can have food that is clean and good and fair, isn't that what you want to be putting in your bodies? Isn't that what we want our children to be putting in their bodies?
First and foremost, we want to get people to think about that first. Why it's important. And that's why I think this education is so valuable, and what you're doing at EAT. As you know, I just recently moved to the area, and when I found your restaurant and saw what you were doing, I was just so excited, because I think it can be a model for other restaurants.
Well, you know, thank you for that. That has been my goal and a bit of a dream, to actually create a space that is all about good, clean, and fair food, not to steal that from slow food, but, you know, it really is applicable. But if you take it a step beyond that and you take a look at, okay, well, who am I foraging from? Because we do not forage 100% from local farmers. That would be impossible, almost impossible for any eatery to do that has, you know, everything that we have on site, from the juice bar and the espresso bar to the marketplace and then the wine and beer bar. There's so much going on, right?
Right.
So we take a look at our model going, okay, well, we want to forage X amount locally. That's organic from small ranches, cheesemaker, and also produce. And then we want to take a look at what company out there is doing the best job, which company is sustainable and ethical within its practices and its foraging. That's a large producer that can get me everything else we need. You know, what chemical company for our dishwashing area is green, you know, from not only from what they're selling, but is it clean enough for my staff to be able to use every single day? Is it going to get on a dish and make somebody sick? And then all the way to the other end of the spectrum with, you know, who are the small artisan producers that are making jams and hot sauces and chips and chocolate, any, you know, all of those wonderful things that we like to consume. Who are the best companies? Who has the best values? Who has not just been bought out by Kraft, or something to that degree? We take so much time and care in making sure. And we're not always 100%. It's not an easy thing to do, but we want to make sure that what you're getting is the best produced item out there, and that we're supporting a small family business, that we're not supporting some huge conglomerate, you know, where we're just another statistics in their P&L statement.
Right. Very, very well said. You're doing an excellent job of that.
Thank you, Carol. Thank you.
Yeah, really, really love what you're doing. And the education piece, how do you do that with what you're doing? Share a little bit about how you talk about sustainability and foraging local food whenever possible. How do you do that in your restaurant with people?
You know, I have to tell you, that's something that I actually just start that I actually notice that I suck at. That's terrible. You know, we have this whole story, you know, and we're doing, you know, a really cool thing. And it's so great because as chefs and all of my cooks in the kitchen, you know, it's our craft and we love it. And then a friend of mine came in who's a marketing genius and she's like, you're not telling your story. How are you telling your story? Where in here do you tell your story besides you coming out and talking to people or reading a little bit about it on your menu? So it stumped me and it was kind of embarrassing. It kind of humbled me a little bit. I'm like, we're not telling the story. Like I should just think people would know by walking in the door. That's so egotistical of me. So we are now, we took the time to go out and take pictures of all of our farmers, ranchers, some of our winemakers, our beer producers, everybody we work with. And we're going to create this wall at Eat that tells that story, because when you can put a story and a face to food, all of a sudden when somebody comes in, they're like, wow, I can't believe you charge $16 for chicken. Well, they can take a look at, you know, Christy from Gone Straw and they see a little bit of her story. Then all of a sudden, oh, okay, I get it. All right, cool. I'm supporting her and her children. This is how she grows it. This is what she's doing. The conversation changes, and that's really important. And we've done a lousy job of it at Eat, and I'm glad you brought that up. But that is something that we are fixing, and we're not incredibly good at it. I would add that one area that we do succeed really well with is our servers, our staff, our cooks. We make sure that they hit a farm at least every 3 months. That they go and they visit one of our farmers as a group, as a big family, and we go and we work with them. So these kids are learning what our farmers go through and how our farmers, what it takes to grow row crops or to raise animals or to make cheese for that matter. And so their hands, you know, are getting in there with them and discovering, you know, this lifestyle. So then when they go back to the eatery, it's easier for them to have a conversation with our guests. And I will say that our staff does that well. And it's kind of a beautiful thing to see all these different kids come in and out my door over the years that are all of a sudden learning something completely different about our food system and the people who grow it.
Right. That's wonderful. And one other thing I wanted to bring up too, when you were talking about some of the price of food, like chicken, for example, you know, years ago, we spent so much more money, so much more percentage of our income on food because it was such a priority. And that percentage has gone down, oh, tremendously. I don't have that figure right in front of me, but I think it's been replaced with things like you were talking about, like everybody, you know, has the latest and greatest electronics, but they don't want to spend $6 for organic eggs.
Well, it goes back to how we started producing food after World War II. I mean, it kind of started a little bit before then, but really that's when you started to see it with the demand on agriculture. So there was this feeling that, oh, we must keep up. We must produce more. How do we grow more chickens? I mean, that's kind of disgusting if you think about it. And it doesn't make any sense. If you run out of pork on a menu or chicken, you run out. And you know what? That's okay. You get it replaced in a day or two. There's just this really sick need for must have everything at all times, regardless. And you can even look at it in our grocery stores and the overproduction in our grocery stores. And we've now lost varietals of fruit, of vegetables, like apples. There's so many varietals of apples. But what do you see when you go to a grocery store? Even oranges, you see a few, like three or four kinds. Well, there's hundreds. Right?
I know.
It's just this, it was just this feeling of, you know, we have to keep up and we have to produce more because everybody wants it. So let's figure out how to do it really super cheap. And that was a huge, huge mistake. And we're starting to see a small reversal of that now because obviously our planet and our soil cannot keep up with that demand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And another thing that I think is really important, and I'm sure you'll agree with this, is just learning to cook. You know,
oh my gosh, yes.
I'm I'm a holistic nutritionist, and when I'm coaching people, I don't really want to cook. And I said, well, then you better have money to go to places like Eat every meal, because you have to eat healthy. You have to learn to cook, or you have to hire somebody to cook for you.
Yeah, it is.
And to teach your kids how to cook.
Yeah, it is. And it's important. I'm very careful on not being a food shaming person, right? Where I shame people for not cooking or doing things maybe the way I would do them. But there's people who just don't know how to cook, and they are very fearful of it. I understand that. We cook meals for people like that on a weekly basis.
Right, right.
I absolutely understand it. My sister happens to be one of them, and we make sure that she gets her 10 meals a week. But for the most part, going back into a question that you had earlier, even about our children and the importance that they're learning about food, get them in the kitchen. Spend a Sunday, or that one day that you have off, prepping stuff for the week, roast a chicken, make soup, make stock, make a salad, make stuff for, you know, tacos or sandwiches, you know, for lunch, and then have the kids be part of that. Or grab a glass of wine and do it with your roommate. You know, if you don't have kids, there's just prepping out food and cooking is so much joy. And it is not, I will argue this and debate this every single time, and I know I'll win. Food is not that expensive. Good food is not expensive. It's not expensive to cook at home. And if we can just take the word cheap away from food, please, then we wouldn't have such a problem with the cost of food and what we're spending.
Well said. My point was, with learning to cook, I just wanted to clear this up a little bit, wasn't on shaming anybody if they don't want to cook.
But no, of course
not. The people that come to me are wanting to really get healthy. And I say, well, if you want to do this, it's going to be easier for you, number one, if you learn to cook.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's that's such a great statement. There are many people that are celiac or, you know, have diabetes, gluten-free or some kind of, you know, or they're vegan or they're going paleo. But and many do come to us with, can you just give us some a few pointers? Like, you know, how do I make something that is completely devoid of gluten now that I found out, excuse me, that I'm celiac? And we do that with great joy, because I don't ever want to see or hear someone say, which I heard once at a clinic, that I'm so sad that I actually have to eat. I wish I just didn't have to eat, because when I eat, it's so painful. And this was a celiac woman, and it broke my heart. So no, it is learning how to cook for you, for your family, and what it is that you can eat and what you derive joy from is so important. It'll make a huge difference in your life.
I agree wholeheartedly. So thank you so much, Leah, for being a guest today. And I hope our other listeners will be inspired by you and do something in their community or in their schools that will assist kids to really know where foods come from.
Oh, heck yeah. And you know what? You'll learn the best jokes from kids.
Yeah, that's so true. They're not censored.
No, they're all poop and fart jokes, but they're awesome. And you will leave with the biggest smile on your face.
Yeah. Well, I love what you're doing. Let's just figure out a way to get more people to come back to the table and have a conversation.
Amen.
So thank you again for being on our show. And we'll be back next time with another great show. Thanks for listening.